Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude, and particularly if you're in South Africa, I hope the lights are back on. It's been a crazy week of, well, in Johannesburg, rain and power failures. My guest this week is Professor Jane Duncan. She's the head of the School of Film Journalism and TV at the University of Johannesburg. She is the author of a number of books, including The Rise of the Securocrats. She has written extensively on security and surveillance issues, as well as on the Fourth Industrial Revolution and the possible impacts of artificial intelligence. She is also one of the founders of the Media Policy and Democracy Project. So it was against that background that we had our discussion. We discussed issues around public and private surveillance, the role of private companies in surveillance in general, particularly in South Africa, the gap between technology and policy, and the need specifically around CCTV of a policy as cameras become more ubiquitous and more intelligent. We also chatted about algorithms and the need for algorithm transparency, and touched on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. She is a skeptic and concerned that, you know, technology is more and more being touted as a cure for all of society's all social issues. We also spoke about how the teaching of journalism is adapting to this technological age and how she wants to educate a new generation of students that are perhaps skeptical of technology, or at least aware of the technology that they are using, the impact of that. So please enjoy my chat now with Professor Duncan. Very much for meeting me today.
It's a pleasure.
At the end of your quite busy and still busy academic year, I imagine.
I hope it was is the end. Unfortunately, it's not. You know what things are like with academic work. Your own work starts at this time of the year.
Yeah, right. So this is your gap to do other projects or plan for next year, I suppose.
It's my gap to do my own research, yes.
Yeah. And what is that now focusing on?
Well, I'm continuing to focus on the growth of the security state and the extent to which we need to be concerned about it. But I'm moving more to focus on the region and the extent we can say that we have surveillance societies characterized by surveillance states in the entire Southern African region. Because I think this side of the world really hasn't been focused on specifically, not sufficiently. And I think that's having a whole, it's allowing a whole range of things to happen. I think that there is a practically unregulated expansion of security powers in Southern Africa. And a massive reinsertion of authoritarianism using surveillance powers in the region. I think we're also seeing the expansion of countries like China in the region to the point where one can almost speak about Southern African countries becoming a neo-colony of China when it comes to surveillance and security matters. So I'm focusing quite heavily on that.
I did mention just when we were chatting offline the sort of prevalence now of private security. Well, I don't know who actually is monitoring those sort of surveillance stacks that we now see on street corners more and more. And it kind of jarred me a little bit, I have to say, because, you know, you mentioned China. And China, there was an article in The Guardian I read recently of some city in China that has 2.8 million, they gave that figure, surveillance cameras in one city. That's obviously quite an extreme sort of view, I suppose. I've spoken to people who have traveled in China, and that's one of the things that sort of they notice a lot. But, I mean, London, for example, is littered with security cameras, whether they're run by the police or private companies. Here it seems to be more private companies that are running these surveillance operations. And I'm just wondering, you know, you talk about the rise of a surveillance state. I mean, is it a kind of free-for-all out there now? Is there an awareness of what policy needs to be in place in order to kind of protect ourselves from this intrusion?
Well, I think that the surveillance state, to the extent that it's expanded massively over the past couple of decades, has only been possible through private sector collusion. So if we think about a very simple example, SIM card registration and also the storing and the processing of our metadata, which is used massively by the police in criminal investigations in a desperately under-regulated manner.
Mm.
None of that massive collection of our personal information, and specifically our metadata, would have been possible without private sector collusion. And I think what struck me about South Africa is how the private sector isn't willing to push back. And I think one of the reasons why is because it's massively lucrative for an increasing number of private sector companies. There's a growing revolving door between the state and the private sector where people who leave the security agencies in the public sector are almost guaranteed of a very lucrative career outside the state. And as a result, they pick up the contracts on the other end.
Sorry, no, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. But I'm just thinking now, when you say lucrative, is it lucrative just in terms of the fact that the private security sector in this country is such a large and lucrative sector, or is it actually the information that has been gathered that is becoming currency? Our private personal information is then becoming currency for those private entities.
Well, I think it's both. Mm. It's both. And if I just reflect on another area where there's a massive private sector expansion, it's public space surveillance. As you correctly point out, in a country like the UK, for instance, it is probably one of the most heavily surveilled countries in the world, particularly when it comes to public space surveillance. But even in the UK, in spite of how blanketed it is, I know there have been a lot of academic questions that have been raised. People have actually studied this stuff rather than relied on impressionistic stories about the successes of CCTV. People who've really studied the stuff have started to realize that CCTV has had limited impacts on crime fighting.
Yes.
And what has often happened is that it's displaced crime rather than reduced or eliminated crime. And CCTV often works well in confined public spaces like parking lots.
Mm.
But it doesn't really have much of an impact on serious crime, particularly when it comes to serious contact crime and murder. Mm. The South African situation is quite different because we've had a patchwork of CCTV that has been, there's been a certain amount of public funding that's been put into it, particularly in the central business districts of different major cities. But often these networks have been rolled out through public-private partnerships.
Mm.
So the private sector, right from the get-go, has played an important role. Yes, in financing the rollout of CCTV, which has meant that CCTV in South Africa, unlike the UK, has tended to follow the money. And what I mean by that is it's tended to be rolled out in areas that are undergoing urban regeneration, and it has been part of parcel of urban regentrification, rather than playing a crime-fighting role in poor and working-class areas where often the most egregious crime is taking place. Mm. So it contributes towards an invisibility of crime and the reinforcement of spatial apartheid. In a city like Cape Town, for instance, and there was a commission of inquiry a number of years ago into failures of policing in Khayelitsha, which actually spoke volumes about the desperately under-resourced nature of CCTV in a place like Khayelitsha relative to how much money has been poured into the Cape Town CBD. I think we've, to an extent, been saved from being a full-blown surveillance state when it comes to public space surveillance, precisely because our surveillance, our CCTV networks in South Africa have been a patchwork that haven't really been joined up. But what we're seeing at the moment through the rollout of a fiber optic network by private service provider Vumacam, we're starting to see the growth of a more joined up public space surveillance network. And I think it's got the makings of a mass surveillance system, which is under-regulated at the moment, and it worries me tremendously, because while I have discomfort about under-regulated public surveillance, I've got even more of a discomfort about under-regulated private surveillance, because private companies are going to operate with a profit motive in mind. And as a result, are going to be inherently less disposed to public interest objectives and public interest oversight when it comes to their activities. And how is Vumacam under-regulated at the moment? Well, the city of Joburg doesn't have a CCTV policy. To its credit, the city of Cape Town has developed one. And that kind of policy is important because it encourages people through a public participation process to identify what they want out of a system like that, how it should be overseen, how it should be regulated, how often it should be audited, whether there has been privacy impact assessments that have been undertaken in order to mitigate the negative privacy impacts of such a surveillance system, all of those, and also how to prevent the spatial inequalities that we see in monitoring of crime. All of these things, I think, should be governed by a CCTV policy before networks get rolled out. Yeah. But what we're seeing at the moment, and this is typical of surveillance state development, the technology runs far ahead of the policy.
Yeah.
And then in addition to that, we don't have an information regulator that's up and running yet. And at least one of the public pronouncements that's made about this particular project, that it doesn't believe that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in public spaces, is a deeply worrying thing for an information regulator to say, given that it hasn't even got out of the starting box. Because another difference between so much of the older legacy CCTV rollout that we had and the current rollout is that the legacy rollout was dumb. It didn't have smart capabilities. Although recently number plate recognition has been introduced. But now we have a privately controlled network where the information processing processes aren't clear, the algorithms that they're using aren't clear. From what we understand from their public statements, they are using number plate recognition and gate recognition. And yet there isn't any evidence of what I'd call algorithmic transparency. So in other words, you know, if people are subject to algorithmic decision making, they need to have some form of redress about how those algorithms are designed and what kind of assumptions that algorithms are making about who is a criminal and who isn't.
Could you just expand on that a little bit, the use of algorithms and what we actually mean by that? Because I'm still not certain. I mean, I kind of understand it's a kind of machine, a learning machine that creates means of analyzing behavior in order to target one in a specific way. Is that a kind of does that make sense? Am I making sense? Do I understand it correctly? What these algorithms do? They're really trying to not only monitor and analyze our behavior, but kind of recreate or reprogram us in a way.
Well, algorithms are mathematical formulae that are used in order to sift through and establish patterns in big data. And algorithms have been developed to sift through big data because, given our unprecedented ability to collect and store huge amounts of data about people, you need some kind of way of making sense of the patterns in the data.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why algorithms have been applied to the analysis of big data in crime fighting and intelligence environments is in order to bring a measure of objectivity to those activities. Because, as we know, one of the dangers of policing and intelligence work is that it can reproduce and reinforce individual investigators' biases, and the biases of you know the dominant or the ruling party or ruling group in society. So algorithms were meant to be a way of actually introducing a measure of objectivity. But if one understands how algorithms are designed by engineers, that often isn't the case. Mm. They are often actually replete with assumptions.
They are biased.
They are often biased in their own right.
Yes.
So, for instance, if a crime-fighting agency has a particular Islamophobic bent, for instance, or is of the mind that Muslim people are more disposed to crime, then it's likely that the algorithms will be loaded in a way that throws up more positives.
To reinforce that bias in a way.
Yes, in order to reinforce that bias. So this is why algorithmic transparency becomes important. Algorithms, one of the dangers of algorithms that are under-regulated and ill-understood is that they can reinforce discrimination. They can lead, for instance, in the context of policing, to the policing of working class, predominantly black, predominantly working class areas, and the stereotyping of black working class, young black working class men, as being more predisposed towards crime. And this is one of the dangers that is increasingly being recognized by social scientists as being one of the dangers of what's known as predictive policing. Because increasingly policing is becoming smart. I think the police have started to recognize that algorithmic analysis can help them to trawl through a huge amount of data in order to predict where crime is likely to happen, rather than focusing on solving crime once crime has happened. They're trying to find a magic formula of being able to prevent
crime. Preempt.
And even preempt crime before it even occurs. So increasingly we're seeing the introduction of smart policing as a way of, and to an extent I can understand the logic, because part of the logic is saying the police are overstretched. And if you're going to adopt a saturation policing approach, then you are inevitably going to stretch your resources to the limit. And you need to find a far more focused way of using the resources that are at your disposal. Also, if you do have people in your criminal records that have demonstrated a pattern of behavior, then you could most likely predict that they are more predisposed to particular kinds of crime, and then you can place particular emphasis on watching those people. It doesn't always work out like that in reality. So the objectivity of these forms of analysis, I think, is open to question. And as a result of that, particularly in relation to the most secretive areas of the state, that is precisely where we need algorithmic transparency and algorithmic accountability as well.
I was reading... there's a couple of things there we can touch on. You mentioned earlier, I mean, it's kind of out of the realms of science fiction in a way, isn't it? That sort of preemptive policing, as you say. The gap between the technology, the policy and technology is something that's not unique to South Africa. I think even sort of, if we call them modern, advanced Western democracies, the United States or the UK are also grappling with these issues a lot. Now, there's a presidential Fourth Industrial Revolution commission that's been appointed or put together. And one of the things there, one of the work streams, as I understand it, I mean, there's a work stream on infrastructure and resources. There's something on research and technology. There's another one that is looking at policy and legislation. What are the sort of challenges that governments are facing in terms of, I mean, what is the right policy when it comes to, if we talk about privacy, access, freedom of expression? It's, you know, there's kind of a lot of things that all come together, don't they, in this world. What are the, because there's a balance between, as you say, being able to surveil people and people having access and people being able to say what they like or gather the information they like and retain their privacy. The balance between those kind of extremes in a way. What is the, is there a happy medium, and how does one reach that?
Well, when it comes to the Presidential Review Panel, as far as I'm concerned, the appropriate policy on 4IR is not to have a policy on 4IR. And what I mean by that is I would prefer to see inequality being far more of a driver of our policymaking in the country, because my concern about the 4IR hype, and I do consider it to be hype, is that it is placing undue emphasis on technological solutions to social problems, rather than identifying the correct role of technology in the cycle of human development. And the thing is, I've seen this movie before as a researcher, and it was called 3IR, or the Information Society, where multilateral institutions and even the South African government portrayed the Information Society as being a solution to the growth problems that the country was experiencing. And if you just added ICTs and STIR, then you would be able to leapfrog over earlier phases of industrial development and agricultural development into a form of development that was driven by ICTs. That led to perverse development. It led to a situation in many countries in Africa where ICTs was introduced in the context of development projects that remained underutilized or often even unutilized, that multipurpose community centers that fell into disrepair because they didn't really address people's more basic needs, telecenters, and internet connections that were unable to be used because people didn't have access to electricity. So this is what I'm saying, the technology needs to find its appropriate place in the cycle of human development. So this is not an argument to be a Luddite. This is an argument to be a technology realist. Unfortunately, a lot of the 4IR hype is being driven by what I'd call technology optimists, or people who think that technology in and of itself, technological take-up in and of itself, will drive social change. I don't, on the other hand, think it's appropriate for us to be technology pessimists, where we reject the technology wholesale. I think that would be inappropriate. But I think we need to be able to take the best out of what big data has to offer without fetishizing it, and without thinking that it's going to be a panacea to all our problems, because ultimately what's going to happen is that 4IR take-up is going to be driven by big capital, and it's going to reinforce inequality and unemployment. And I think that that's what's happening at the moment. If you look at the banks, for instance, there's the banks are feeling the pressure, they claim, in order to go digital. But I'm sure you've had the same experiences as I have. I would have preferred to continue going into branches in order to have person-to-person service, because it's just so much better, so much more superior to do your banking in that kind of way. And one of the reasons why I stopped doing that and I went digital in my banking was because it just became more and more unbearable to go into the branches, because the branches weren't being properly resourced.
Yes.
So it's created a self-fulfilling prophecy where the banks may claim that they are losing revenue because increasingly the international trend is to go digital. But they themselves have starved the human component of banking to the point where people don't want to go into the branches anymore and transact on a human-to-human basis. And I think this is the kind of conversation that we should be having about the take-up of 4IR. What kind of jobs need to be saved?
Yep.
And what kind of jobs could be got rid of in our society because they are not good jobs? We need to have that discussion first before we start setting up presidential review panels on 4IR and having universities such as my own putting 4IR out there as, you know, key
the
branding
panacea. Yeah.
Yes, component of its activities. We haven't had the proper
yes,
social, political, and economic conversations that we need to have before we get to that point. And my fear is that it's just going to become a grand distraction in the way that the information society did.
Yes, I am interested in this whole notion of technology, as a sort of silver bullet, this, you know, bridging the digital divide that we've heard about for 30 years now and still don't see any or that much bridging. And if you go on to, for example, the World Economic Forum, I mean, they're very big on 4IR in Africa and how it's going to sort of change education, improve healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. But you still don't really see that, how that's, you know, where that all kind of fits in. I do get it that, for example, a kid in a far-flung rural area who has access to a computer can then sort of access all the information they require and maybe, you know, free their education, you know, become almost like a self-educated person, whatever. But it's also so I can kind of see where that argument is coming from. At the same time, the changing nature of work, and as you are alluding to, you know, what is going to be the impact of technology on work, and what do we need to be thinking about when we look at the future of work, particularly in a country like South Africa?
I've got no doubt that digital technologies can enrich the education experience and extend education into areas where education may be, at the moment, difficult to access or even inaccessible. But that shouldn't remove the human element of education.
Mm.
And I think what we're seeing at the moment is a form, a kind of hype that is putting technology before the need for human interaction in educational activities. And this doesn't surprise me at all because if we look at the provenance of 4IR as a concept, it comes or has been developed fundamentally by Charles Schwab from the World Economic Forum. So it is thoroughly and completely a World Economic Forum concept and represents those interests. And just as a periodizing concept, it's also highly problematic as well to describe the kind of society that we live in. The logic is that this is a fourth industrial revolution that's been preceded by previous revolutions. Mm. But this is not a revolution. In fact, the way it's been taken up as a concept is fundamentally conservative, not revolutionary. If we understand revolution as being, you know, the overturning of existing social relations in order to make societies fundamentally better places, we can see that that already isn't taking place in South Africa, that it's actually reinforcing dominant social relations rather than remaking them in any progressive kind of way. There's also, you know, claims that are being made about 4IR that it's a new and unprecedented form of society, and we need to get with the program in order to get with progress. So there's a modernizing element to the concept. But if you wanted to talk the revolution talk, I'd make an argument that probably the first industrial revolution, the forcing of the people off the farms and out of subsistence agriculture into the cities and industrial production was probably far more revolutionary. I find it difficult to draw a clear line between the Third Industrial Revolution and the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Yes, I understand that 4IR is about the application of artificial intelligence and machine learning to the data that is being generated by the internet. But I don't think it is at its heart fundamentally different from what has been called the Third Industrial Revolution. Mm. So all of this points to the fact that there are governmental and I think corporate interests that have a vested interest in talking up 4IR talk, because it's also hugely lucrative as well. As has been said, data is the new oil. And you can only turn data into the new oil if you encourage people to believe that this is a fundamental driver of social progress.
Hmm. I want to, if we can, just switch focus a little bit now to the work of the school. You're the head of film, journalism, and TV at the University of Johannesburg. I just want to, in this context, get a sense of how your teaching has changed in the internet age. How are you adapting your teaching to a not only changing business climate when it comes to journalism and the press, the media industry in the country, but also the implications of technology on sort of information gathering and dissemination of information. Could I just get a sense from you sort of what your challenges are when sort of preparing your students for a kind of a, it seems to be quite a different media landscape to perhaps the one you and I grew up in. I mean, obviously we are in a post-apartheid era as well, which has had obviously a lot of implications for freedom of expression, etc., etc. But just to try and get a sense from you is what sort of more, I don't know, philosophical or ethical challenges have been for you and your staff and your students, I suppose.
Well, what I've discovered, particularly teaching first year, is that young people are very digitally enabled. They've grown up in a society where they haven't known an existence outside the internet and outside social media. So they grow up on their devices, and they're constantly on their devices. But typically they don't have an absolute clue of how their devices actually function. And what their devices are storing and how they're processing that information, what is meant by privacy settings, how important it is to read the terms of service, which I'm sure hardly any of us ever do, before actually using a particular app, how to protect their data, and how to demand what I would call data sovereignty. I don't think many people, even older people, not just young people, are aware of the fact that they've got rights. Well, firstly, that they're generating data.
Yes.
And secondly, that other people are processing that data.
Yeah.
And thirdly, that they have rights over their data. I also don't think that many people, young and old, realize that because they're not paying for many of these apps and services, that, yay, it's a free lunch, they can use the apps and services to their heart's content without realizing that they are the commodity.
Yes.
That these companies are constantly analyzing and selling to advertisers. So for me, one of the challenges is starting to encourage students to understand what's happening on their devices. They may be saying things on their devices, but what are their devices saying about them? To whom? Where is that data going to? If you do a Google search, for instance, one of the fascinating discussions I've had with my students is, how is it that next time you get onto Google in order to do other searches, you will find searches being thrown up that relate to your interests?
Yeah.
So then we start having a discussion about issues like confirmation bias and filter bubbles and how filter bubbles get developed. Students don't understand how, if they do a Google search and then they go onto Facebook, they see an ad pop up there. Or they've just sent a WhatsApp message about shopping at a particular place and then suddenly an advert pops up on Facebook about that very thing that they said that they were going to shop for. Mm. So that is the challenge, I think, making students more aware of how the data actually functions and the hidden invisible decisions that are being taken about them and their lifestyles and their interests and how they are being profiled so that they can start having more agency in their decision-making about how they use their devices. Mm. That's important. And often, you know, students recognize that stuff is going on, that somehow increasingly their Facebook feed or their Twitter feed or their searches are increasingly locking them into universes that reinforce their own biases rather than open up the world to them.
Mm.
And I think it's important for them to understand how that works. And then you have to start introducing the concept of algorithms and how algorithms work.
I'm just recently in the habit now of doing Google searches or making, whatever you say, making Google searches on topics that I'm completely uninterested in order to hopefully fox the machine somehow.
Game I don't know. The algorithms.
Well,
yes.
I mean, just to confuse it a little bit by, I don't know, doing a search on knitting or, I don't know, Jesus or whatever, you know, just to, because I've noticed more and more, it's become more and more connected or insidious that, as you say, you'll do a search for something, travel, maybe a city, and it won't even be on, like if you could do a search or mention something on Facebook, it'll pop up on your Instagram. Or, you know, if you do a Google search, it'll come up in your face. You know, it's all, you suddenly realize how linked the whole thing is. And we're not even then talking about the fact that your phone can actually listen to you on top of everything else. It's just, you feel like you, well, I feel like I'm in a constant sort of battle with the technology in a way. I mean, you appreciate it. It is amazing, all this information at your fingertips, and yet at the same time, to just, I don't know if it's being aware of or just somehow trying to fox the algorithm a little bit.
There are some downsides as well, by the way, to having such digitally enabled students, which is a rise in plagiarism.
Hmm.
We have an ongoing problem with plagiarism, and plagiarism, in fact, is becoming increasingly sophisticated, where there are deep tools inside the deep web that allow students to plagiarize in ways
to kind of rewrite
that
often,
wouldn't be picked up by your conventional plagiarism tools.
Yeah.
So that's one thing we want to watch out for. But I think the challenges for journalism students are many. One of the challenges is for students to understand the tech so that we can encourage more tech journalists on these issues who I think are also quite critical about these developments as well, who are not just technology boosterists, but also are engaging critically with
skeptical,
the implications of
yeah.
all of this, yes, including for people's implications for people's privacy and their right to data protection. So you also need to have students who are aware of basic data protection principles, but also interdisciplinarity and even transdisciplinarity is becoming increasingly important, where in order to teach journalism and communication scholars in a sufficient level of depth about these things, you also need to bring the engineers in. So you need to engage in an interdisciplinary dialogue between the engineers and the journalism scholars in order for the engineers to explain what goes on inside that algorithmic black box So why do we see the inputs and the outputs that we do? You know, one of the confounding problems of an AI-driven society is what's known as the black box problem. And the black box problem is that if people don't understand how algorithms work, then they're not going to trust the decisions that are made by the algorithms. So if someone is denied credit, for instance, on the basis of an algorithmic decision, then that person is not necessarily going to trust because there wasn't a human in the loop. I think it's these kinds of issues encouraging journalism students to be robust about these issues and demanding that there are answers about how the black box, what is actually going on inside the black box. And of course, AI developers are not going to want to reveal that because it's their secret sauce. Mm. It's what makes their profits go round. But if AI is, if automated decision-making is going to have a significant impact on human rights, if someone's going to be denied a significant amount of credit, for instance, on the basis of improper inputs that have been made into the black box, then people should have a right to hold the developers to account and should have the right to appeal as well. Any automated decision-making, in fact, people should be forewarned about. There should be a health warning on the box before you get subjected to an algorithmic decision-making that this is, in fact, taking place. And you should be able to contact the people who are responsible for designing those algorithms in order to take up any discomfort. So we need to produce a generation of journalists who understand these things and are able to ask the necessary questions. But in order to do that, we need to be able to function on a transdisciplinary basis because there is so much about the tech and how the tech functions that people who are in the humanities won't know. At the same time, there are people who design these systems who are not humanities-enabled, who won't be thinking about the human factor in how automated decision-making functions. So I think that there's a synergy that can potentially happen between the two disciplines.
Mm. I just want to touch a little now. I'm going to... Tim Berners-Lee, who's sort of seen now as the creator, the inventor of the internet, or maybe not as we know it today, but as it was conceived 30 years ago. Mm. He's now published this contract for the web that has, you know, three different components. It's got a government component, it has a business component, and has an individual component, and essentially, from what I can gather, it's trying to sort of, I'm not sure if it's a little bit too late, it's sort of trying to get back to the sort of romance of the web as a place of community, as a place where access would be for all, where they're just sort of, it's just a purely positive experience that everyone will see benefits from the internet and have access to the internet. What is your sort of take on that? I mean, is it possible to kind of roll back the surveillance state? I mean, we have, he talks about sort of communities of like-minded people, you know, all coming together on the internet for the benefit of humanity kind of thing. It seems we kind of way beyond that, you know, given kind of the toxicity of community groups on the internet, and I'm just wondering if you even see this as anything's possible, given the fact that Facebook and Google are some of the companies that have signed up for this contract of the web, who seem to be the most kind of, well, if not evil, seem to be the organizations that are behind the whole surveillance capitalism as it's developing today.
It's ironic for me that the very governments and companies that are responsible for turning the web into a surveillance medium are the ones who want to tell us how to solve the problem. And I think that does need to be resisted, because very clearly, while, you know, that they can certainly be capable of reform and make a contribution, they cannot lead such reform. I think that any initiative to try and return the internet to being a free and open medium that operates on the basis of net neutrality and that resists the temptation to carve it up into walled gardens that are owned and controlled by large dominant companies, I think is to be welcomed. And I think that there have been many initiatives that have taken place. And I think the reason why companies like Google and Facebook are trying to come up with these innovations is precisely because they recognize that they could be headed off at some stage in the future by a groundswell of citizens saying, this is not what the internet was meant to be and should be about in future, and this is not the kind of society that we want to live in. I think that those kinds of pushbacks have been growing, particularly in the wake of the Edward Snowden revelations from 2013 onwards, which have demonstrated, you know, the full extent of surveillance state and surveillance society expansion across the globe. And I think that precisely because of this pushback, these companies are getting worried. We must think 20 to 30 years ahead, and we must ask ourselves if Google and Facebook don't change their business models, are they still going to continue to exist? So even in terms of browsing habits, for instance, we've seen an increasing number of people shift away from Google. We've seen people using browsers that are much more privacy sensitive and that don't operate on a collected all basis. Increasingly, we're seeing people using virtual private networks more and more for their transactions, using encryption in order to hide their personal data from the from private companies and from the authorities as well. So I think an increasing number of people are saying no. And also, there's an increasing pressure on communication companies to adopt encryption as the default mode of communication. So if you think of WhatsApp, for instance, WhatsApp a couple of years ago introduced end-to-end encryption because they knew that if they didn't, then they would maybe sooner, maybe later, probably sooner rather than later, be out of a job and be overtaken by secure messaging services like WhatsApp and Telegram. So I think one of the advantages that perhaps we don't talk about sufficiently of the Snowden disclosures was that encryption has become the rule rather than the exception to our communications online. And increasingly people are turning away from unencrypted options. And I think that that kind of pressure on the communication companies to change is most likely going to filter through to the Google and Facebooks of the world and put them under pressure to offer more secure forms of communication. There's also fascinating initiatives taking place in different parts of the world that perhaps we don't speak about sufficiently, because I think with Cambridge Analytica and the manipulation of many elections around the world, I think the focus has been particularly on Facebook and the potential for misinformation and disinformation. But if you look at a city like Barcelona, for instance, that has been attempting to reinvent smart cities, and it's doing so by adopting an open data approach towards smart cities, where rather than using smart city strategies like Joburg is, for instance, as a gateway for private companies to come in and to suck out and control and commercialize as much of people's data as possible, they are recognizing people's data as being a public resource that is owned and controlled by the city on behalf of the public. Yeah. So when I was there, there were some very interesting innovations that they were talking about, like setting up a cooperative Uber that's run on a cooperative basis that doesn't exploit people's personal information as a ride-sharing service, but is owned and controlled by the taxi drivers in Barcelona, who've done a very good job, by the way, of resisting the takeover of
the Uberfication
Uber,
the
Uberfication of Barcelona. And there's a number of other open data projects that they've been attempting there as well. So those kinds of things, I think, are very interesting. There's a huge pushback against the gig economy, which of course is another feature of 4IR.
Airbnb,
as well, the
for example, I think is also banned from Barcelona, or there were some definite moves, I think, against Airbnb, for example, as well.
Yes.
Barcelona. And other cities, of course.
Yes. People are also whose work is casualized through the platform economy are finding some fascinating ways of actually pushing back against the platform economy as well. Crashing platforms by saturating platforms with messages and then watching them fall over. Denial of service attacks.
I wasn't even aware of that.
This has become a form of resistance,
right,
for instance, by workers in the platform economy as a means of striking. It's the new form of the strike. Replacing the old form of the strike where workers would actually sit in the factory and down tools.
Yeah.
This is a new form of downing tools.
That's fascinating, yeah.
So there's a whole load of stuff that's going on that may not immediately be recognized as a demand for reinventing how we communicate online. But if we really analyze it as it's at its heart, it is.
Yeah, that's amazing. I suppose it gives one hope, because it's easy to sort of just look at this avalanche, this corporate online avalanche, and just like kind of feel completely overwhelmed, and you know that you're always under, I mean, just that realization sometimes that you are under surveillance right now. As I am online, I'm being surveilled somehow, somewhere. It's quite a, it makes me sort of now suddenly quite uncomfortable. But you also struggle to think how you can get out of that and how you can escape it. I think that's sort of one of the maybe modern existential kind of moments of our lives today.
Sure. Well, you get out of it app by app, service by service. So if it means shifting and making a conscious shift from the comfort of using Google, because it's easy, it designs your environment, your online environment for you. It's so seductive. To shifting to a browser that operates on a no-track basis. That is an important development. A lot of my friends have gone off Facebook completely.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to contribute
to give
data.
That information. Yeah, I mean, I'm also pretty much out of it. I sort of pop into my Facebook every now and again. I very rarely am putting stuff on Twitter. I left also quite maybe a year and a half ago.
But the new form of strike is to withhold your data,
which
anyone can do very easily. They just have to get out of the crack addict approach towards their online lives.
I just want to, we need to finish off the Media Policy and Democracy Project. Could you just tell us a little bit about that, how it came about, and what the purpose of the project is?
Well, the Media Policy and Democracy Project is a joint project of my department at UJ and the Department of Communication Science at UNISA. Originally, when I was still at Rhodes University, we established it as a joint project between the journalism school there and UNISA. And it actually came out of a very different set of circumstances to the ones that we're discussing. Things have kind of moved on since then. So it started out as a response to the media freedom threats that the country was experiencing in about 2011, when the ruling ANC was proposing the establishment of a statutory media appeals tribunal as a replacement to the appeals body of the Press Council. And the Press Council was under tremendous pressure to reform its processes, to respond to criticisms that it was a lapdog rather than a watchdog of the press. So we did a lot of work on press self-regulation and co-regulation and contributed towards the redesign of the Press Council as a means of staving off the threat of statutory regulation. At that time, there was also the threat of a very punitive Protection of State Information Bill.
Yes.
Which was extremely broad. It was so broad that it threatened to allow public organizations as diverse as the from the police to the Joburg Zoo, the opportunity to be able to classify information. So we did quite a bit of research and provided research support for civil society to be able to undertake the campaigns that we're all aware of against the Protection of State Information Bill or the Secrecy Bill. So that's how we were born. And we also started doing work increasingly around press transformation, because also at that time there was a big hoo-ha about the extent to which the press was transformed. We then started looking at the extent of media diversity in the country and the extent to which the media properly reflected the complexity of the society in which it operated. We developed a media diversity measurement tool for use by policymakers, contributed in that way to a number of policy processes. We've made contributions to the communication regulator, ICASA, to government, to a range of different platforms. And we did that on the understanding that there's very little participatory media and communication policy making, and even less contributions being made by media and communication scholars. So we wanted to provide informed, evidence-based research policy proposals. And then we started working on internet freedom and surveillance.
Yes.
That's how we landed up sitting here talking about these issues.
So just, I mean, to if we can just conclude now, what is your sense of where policy, government policy, is in respect of the internet and freedom of expression, and what do you think needs to happen in order for us to the country and the citizens of the country to be able to operate? What's the word? Maybe not mutually beneficial, but just operate in a space that sort of sees the full benefits of what the internet perhaps can do for a society, both in terms of information gathering and dissemination, and also expression and being able to, I suppose, take advantage of the freedoms that our constitution allows us.
Make no mistake, we live in a very free society. The more I travel, the more I realize how free we are and how lucky we are, particularly in this era of growing global surveillance and this era of borders, militarization and securitization of borders, the weaponization of national identity, and the increasing rise of the right globally. We're damn lucky, actually, that we don't have that here. And as a result, I think we've got a certain level of, in fact, a considerable level of protections of basic rights and freedoms. I don't notice the same kind of erosion of fundamental rights and freedoms as we see in other parts of the world. So I think, make no mistake, I think here we are lucky. And we need to hold on to the fact that we are. I think the democracy is experienced very differently depending on class, race, and gender in our society. I think we've got two and probably more fundamentally different experiences of democracy. I think that, you know, in working class areas, being able to speak out as a whistleblower is a life-threatening activity often. We've seen people being killed, shot dead for opening their mouths about corruption and mismanagement in different municipalities. And many of those killings have never been solved. Hopefully now with the shift in the National Prosecuting Authority, things will change. But I actually think one of the fundamental obstacles to realizing freedom of expression in the country, including online, is not even where we're looking for it. It's not looking at internet policy or looking at laws that impact on freedom online or freedom of expression in the media. It's actually looking at having a robust prosecuting authority that can hold people to account for undertaking possibly the most brutal form of censorship that we know, which is the assassination of whistleblowers. Mm. I think that will make a tremendous difference. I think South Africa, when it comes to online freedom, South Africa could potentially play a much more important leadership role in securing online rights and freedoms and making sure that this drive towards militarizing and securitizing the internet, which is going to push freedoms off the internet, is reversed. And the fact that South Africa is now back on the UN Security Council is important because it needs to raise cybersecurity as a global security issue. Mm. Because in people, if people increasingly, especially the more powerful governments, are going to continue to weaponize the internet and pursue cyber warfare as a means of gaining military advantage, then I think we have a massive global security problem on our hands. South Africa can play a role there. I think South Africa can also play an important role in the global governance forums in order to make sure that we do achieve a free and open internet rather than an internet that is increasingly enclosed by a combination of large multinational corporates and the most powerful surveillance powers in the world. I don't see South Africa doing enough of that. But in our freedom, we must not give our freedom away. We must use that freedom in order to globalize that freedom, including to countries that consider themselves to be so-called major democracies and yet are letting the world down when it comes to the quality of global democracy.
Mm. Professor, thanks very much for your time this morning. That was a fantastic discussion.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyed that, even if it was just to make you aware of how surveilled you are every day, every moment you use a device. It was good to hear from her how people are pushing back both against surveillance capitalism in general and the gig economy, and also I think her observation on the leading role South Africa can play in achieving a free and open internet for all the citizens of the world. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating or comment. You can also find Voices from SA on Spotify, Deezer, Radio Public, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.